Now, when somebody says Mexican food, you might think of the standard tacos, burritos, enchiladas, and tamales. And those are indeed Mexican fare, but they don't completely represent the full variety of Mexican cuisine. In this week's edition of Food Friday, our guest is going to take us on a tour. Patty Heenich is host of the public TV series Patty's Mexican Table. She's spent the last decade seeking out culinary gems of her home country, some pretty well known, others local specialties passed down through the generations. Then she figured out how to prepare the best version of those recipes to make them accessible for people outside of Mexico. You can see the results in her brand new book, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a favorite Mexican dish? Do you have one that's been in your own family maybe for a really long time? If you've experienced regional cuisines of Mexico, either by growing up there or touring there, what were some of your favorite finds? And you need some advice from Patty. Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Patty Heenich joins us now. Her new book is Treasures of the Mexican Table, Classic Recipes, Local Secrets, scheduled to come out on November 23rd. Patty, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me on, Rob. A treat.
This a treat for us too, Patty. Now, this book has been a literal journey. Can you talk about your travels around Mexico and what you were looking for this book?
Absolutely. So, yeah, many, many years in the making. So, I come from Mexico City, and I lived there all my life until I married my husband, moved to Texas, switched careers, you know, after I had my two kids and went from political analysis to cooking. And ever since then, I've just made my life's mission to share everything and anything from Mexico, culture, food, ingredients, stories. And in this book, which is my most ambitious so far, I just went to find, you know, everybody now knows guacamole, and so many things are in the American culinary lingo, like taco and taco Tuesday and taco night, and everybody seems to know birria these days. But in this book, I bring 150 classic recipes that are heirlooms, that have been passed on through generations, that are treasured, and they may be from a little town or micro region or macro region, but most of these have not crossed the border. And I'm here to tell you, you love Mexican food already? Well, here's more. And this is going to enrich your weekly menus and your table and your family life, and I hope people love it as much as I do.
So, Patty, I grew up in a small Midwestern town. I got to say, well into my life, I had a pretty narrow view of what Mexican food was. And it's very slowly dawned on me. Mexico's really big. And it has a lot of variety. Can you tell us just how much variety there is within Mexico?
Absolutely. I mean, I'm still in awe, Rob, to be honest. And the more I know and the more I travel and the more I go back, I'm continuously treading, you know, back and forth. And you think you know a place, I think I know a state, I think I know a region, and I go back to try those classics. And I come back and find those classics, and there's many more. There's new dishes, new ways to use ingredients, and people are also really going back and trying to recover or bring to the surface pre-Hispanic dishes and takes. And between the combination of regions, historical eras, and the creativity of Mexican cooks, there never seems to be enough new things to try. So I, you know, here you can find food from all of the country, and each dish has a story tied to it. And I really work so hard to bring these recipes to your kitchen in a way that they're accessible, doable, repurposable, and mostly that they will bring you something that you can try and you're going to say, I want to make this again. And for the people who try them, I'm hoping they're going to say, we want that recipe. And that when you share it, you're also going to be able to share stories.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Patty Heenich about her new book out just in a week or so, Treasures of the Mexican Table, Classic Recipes, Local Secrets. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have a question for Patty or you want to share your favorite Mexican meal you've ever had, whether you grew up with it or whether you've encountered it as a tourist somewhere in Mexico, love to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. Let's talk about ingredients a little bit, Patty. One thing I loved in your book is you made it so that it's stuff mostly we could find in our local grocery store. And I want to start with tomatoes. I thought, oh, what kind of tomato is Patty going to point me toward? Roma tomatoes, which you could find pretty often, especially good ones in the summer. Why are Roma tomatoes one of your first choices if you're making a salsa?
Well, Roma tomatoes are just so juicy and fleshy and have a wonderful consistency for salsas and stews and soups. They're rich. I mean, I always advise people, when you bring tomatoes into your home, if they're not super fully ripe, like bursting, you know, leave them in your kitchen counter and let them continue to ripen. And if you can't find Roma tomatoes, which I think are really the best for like saucy, messy food, which is like what I like, any tomatoes that you find at the store, just let them ripen. I'd rather you use a very ripe tomato that's not a Roma than a green unripe Roma. And if you can't find fresh tomatoes that you're loving, you know, say in the middle of winter, you can use a can of crushed tomatoes. And there's many recipes in my cookbook that call for fire roasted or charred or broiled or roasted tomatoes. And you can now find cans of fire roasted tomatoes. So it's all much more accessible and easy than when I first moved to the US, Rob. I mean, I swear 20 years ago, you were lucky if you found a fresh jalapeno. And I'm talking even in Dallas, Texas. These days, I guess it has to do not only with the demand of, you know, the American audience. People are so much familiar with Mexican food and ingredients that people don't only want to go out and eat tacos, but people want to make Mexican food at home. So that demand has helped, you know, increase the availability. And you can really find almost anything, if not in stores, online.
Let's check out, Patty, one of the recipes you shared with us. It's at WPR.org/Food Friday. This one, I could see it going on a Thanksgiving side dish sort of table here. Green beans in corn sauce with pumpkin seeds. First of all, tell us where this recipe is coming from in Mexico.
Yes, that is one of my favorite recipes in the entire book, Rob. I'm so happy you chose that. And if you see the photo of that recipe, you see the stunning green beans, the chunky red tomato sauce on top, and the crushed pepitas. And you would think that a new modern chef came up with this vegan, you know, really regal dish. And this is a recipe that has existed in the Yucatan Peninsula in the state of Campeche for centuries. People have been making it in Mexico since pre-Hispanic times. And this is the beauty about classic recipes, that they stand the test of time. Of course, let me describe this recipe to you. It's green beans that you quickly sear. And after they started to brown, you pour over them a sauce that you make by pureeing fresh corn. If you don't find fresh corn, you can use thawed from frozen. You puree the corn with a little bit of fresh cilantro or epazote if you find it. And then you cook the beans in that corn sauce. And they've begun to crisp. And then they start cooking in this sweet corn sauce that becomes velvety and so creamy. And it starts to stick on the green beans. And then you take them out of the pan. And this is really less than 10 minutes. And then you top that with a chunky tomato salsa that you make in a snap. And you garnish that with ground or chopped toasted pumpkin seeds. The combination of flavors is just insane, because you have the green beans, you have that really velvety sweet corn sauce, you have the tart and almost sweet tomato sauce, and then the salty and nutty pumpkin seeds. And it is such a delight. It can be a side. It can be a main. People who are vegetarians or vegans are going to feel like you really spoiled them by giving them something so delicious and not just a boring side of, you know, just bland green beans. And this is a recipe that, of course, it's adapted in my cookbook so that you can make it in your kitchen. But this is a recipe that used to be made by having the ingredients in a pot and throwing in a rock that was heated until it was really just burning hot. And it was thrown in the pot, and that's how the ingredients used to cook. And these were talking about pre-Hispanic times. But this recipe has evolved and it's been maintained and it's been passed on through the centuries. And I feel so, you know, so much pride to be able to pass on these recipes so that other people outside of Mexico or Mexicans who aren't from the Yucatan Peninsula can get to know it. And it's, you know, the part of cooking that it's so beautiful because it's communal. You know, these recipes are here before we get here. And these recipes will remain after we leave. So it's just an honor to be able to pass these on.
You can find that recipe at WPR.org/Food Friday. Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Matt is with us in Green Bay. Matt, hi.
Hi, how you doing? Patty, I love your show, and I love how it's evolved over the years. My question is, I'm from La Frontera, in Las Cruces, New Mexico, which is like a green chili capital of the United States. And when I learned how to make chile rellenos there, they were crispy and stuffed with cheese, and you would just serve them crispy and eat them with a fork. But since I've moved to Green Bay, we have a lot of people who make chile rellenos from poblanos, and they fry them up, but then they just drown them in tomato sauce. What is it like the chile rellenos? Why is it always drowned down in Central Mexico?
Is that a different regional approach, Patty?
Yeah, and that is such a great question. And in fact, in my new cookbook, Treasures of the Mexican Table, I have a few variations of the chile relleno. And I love that you're asking this question, Matt, because there's a universe of chile rellenos. So the chile rellenos that you're talking about, it's the most popular version. The poblano chiles that are large, chubby, can be super stuffed, and they're typically fire roasted, sweated, and peeled, just like the roasted pimientos, you know, that you use in Italian cooking. So the same thing, the same process is done to poblano chiles. And then the chiles are stuffed either with melted cheese or with picadillo, which is a combination of ground meat cooked in tomato sauce and olives and raisins and almonds, or beans. And then that chile goes drowned in a rich tomato sauce. It can either go directly like that, or most traditionally, that chile that's stuffed goes battered in an egg batter, then fried, which is what you're talking about, and then dressed in that sauce. And I think that is one of the most beloved and the most well-known of Mexican chile rellenos from Central Mexico and Puebla and regions that have a lot of Mexicans that have moved to the U.S. So I guess that's why it's becoming so popular now. But there are many other chile rellenos. I have a chile relleno in the cookbook that is actually a cold chile relleno, and it's a cold and pickled chile relleno. Wow. And it is a delight. And I have been wanting to make this since my first cookbook. And Rox Martin, who I'm so lucky to have had as an editor for all of my cookbooks, kept on telling me on Cookbook 1 and Cookbook 2, I don't think America is ready for this one. And this year, you know, this book, I'm like, we're ready. So imagine a Mexican-style Nisua salad stuffed in an exuberant fire-roasted poblano chile. This is what this is like. So you take the fire-roasted poblanos, which is, you know, it's a technique that's very simple to do. And then you make a marinade with oil and vinegar, and in that oil you cook onions and garlic and some spices. You marinate the chiles in that until they're slightly pickled, like the pickled jalapenos brine kind of. And you can make this ahead of time and put it in the fridge, and they will wait for you for weeks. And what I do is that when my husband comes home really late from work, which didn't happen throughout the pandemic because we've been locked in, but now that he's starting to go back to the office, and I'm like, no, don't go. But then when he comes back at, you know, very late hours of the day or the night, I just quickly make a tuna salad with Mexicans love mayo. I don't know if people know, but, you know, tuna, mayo, lime juice, a little bit of celery, a little bit of onion. And you take out those pickled chiles, you stuff that with tuna. And I can't begin to describe the flavor of that.
That sounds great.
Yeah.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Patty Heenich about her new cookbook called Treasures of the Mexican Table, Classic Recipes, Local Secrets. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions or your favorite Mexican food experiences. You can also find recipes at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our Food Friday conversation with Patty Heenich from Patty's Mexican Table on PBS. She's got a new book coming out, Treasures of the Mexican Table, Classic Recipes, Local Secrets. Still time for your calls or Facebook comments on the Ideas Network Facebook page, your experiences, favorites, questions for Patty at 800-642-1234. Patty, we heard from Paul on Facebook who shared a great experience. Didn't say where, though. Says a quesadilla in a market was amazing. Stretchy cheese, fresh epazote and squash blossoms, and the tortillas made right on the spot. You mentioned that epazote earlier, Patty. Can you talk about that as a spice? You can use it. There's fresh and more available here, I think, dried.
Yeah, absolutely. And the quesadilla that he's sharing, that Paul is sharing, is a typical quesadilla that you find throughout Mexico and increasingly in the U.S., which means you can find it, but not as much as Mexico, but at least you can find it and hopefully more and more. Epazote is a deeply Mexican herb. It is an herb that really defines us. It's very perfumed. It's very intense. It has a very deep, clean taste. It's the best way that I can describe it. You need to use it judiciously because it's that intense. And it's supposed to be a really good digestive, which is why many people cook their beans with epazote. And it's absolutely delicious with cheese in a quesadilla because it brings some kind of like fragrant aromatic. It's so hard to describe the taste, Rob, that you really have to try it. You can find the epazote herb increasingly in the U.S. And then if you learn to make your homemade corn tortillas, then you can be making those quesadillas anytime. Now, the blossom, the squash blossoms, which is so common in Mexico, it's much harder to find here. And in Mexico, it's much more accessible and price-wise, much more affordable. But I think we're going to get there.
I've used epazote, and I learned the hard way a little bit. It goes a long way with dried epazote, but I'll take your advice now and try it again.
Yeah, so epazote, yeah, you have to use it judiciously. So I would say if you're using the dried epazote, you need to use like 3 times the amount just because it's like very different in its fresh than its dried form. But it has a very unique taste. I love it.
Well, let's check out some dessert, Patty, because we're getting close to the end of our conversation. You've shared with us a classic creamy flan. That's definitely a dessert I think about when I think about Mexican food. Can you share a little bit of the story behind it?
Yes. And flan, I mean, there's so many different kinds of flan. I was just now at the border, you know, aside from Patty's Mexican Table, this year I launched a new docu-series on Primetime with PBS and Amazon Prime. That's all about the borderlands. It's called La Frontera with Patty Heenich. And I went from El Paso, Ciudad Juarez, to Brownsville. And it was incredible. You know, the quality of food is just so phenomenal. And people think that along the Texas-US-Mexico border, you only find Tex-Mex. But you find phenomenal Mexican, you find phenomenal Texan, and you find these regional cuisine, these Tex-Mex cuisine, that's so different in the different parts of the Texas-Mexico border. And you realize that Tex-Mex food is so different at every spot. It's very different in El Paso from the Rio Grande Valley. And I'm connecting it to these, Rob, because there were so many flans. And they were just absolutely extraordinary, from the round individual ones, which is like the creamy one I have in my new cookbook, which is like the flan that you crave for. It's the flan that you find in fondas. It's the flan that you find in, I would guarantee, any Mexican home. It's made with 4 or 5 ingredients, depending if you want to add more flavor or not. Like you can make it like I do here, or you can add some orange rind. But it's just very satisfying. It's satiating. It's after a Mexican meal, especially. It's creamy, it's mild, it's not incredibly sweet, and it's cold, so it's kind of refreshing and soothing.
And Patty, in just our last minute or so, can you leave us some inspiration for people to try cooking and try more variety of cooking inspired by Mexican food?
Yes, I just think that, when you're cooking something new and you're trying something new, it's just a way to open a window to learn so many stories and to enrich your home not only with a new food or dish, but really stories that can be shared and passed on. So I would recommend that when people hopefully get my cookbook, they find a dish or two that they want to try and begin with, and they'll realize that they're all approachable and easy. And I hope they will read the stories. And as they make the food, they will also share the stories.
Patty, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us again today.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Patty Heenich is the host of the PBS series Patty's Mexican Table and the series she mentioned, La Frontera. Her newest book is called Treasures of the Mexican Table: Classic Recipes, Local Secrets. It comes out on November 23rd. What? You can't wait that long? Hey, good news. We've got a couple recipes from that book. You can get them right now at WPR.org/FoodFriday. Try out maybe this weekend or maybe for Thanksgiving. Green beans and corn sauce with pumpkin seeds. Looks great. The picture is awesome. If you're in the mood for some dessert, that classic creamy flan she was just talking about, give them a go. Let us know how they turned out over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. And you can share your Mexican food favorites. You can do that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Your best experience, maybe while traveling and eating Mexican food or growing up with Mexican food yourself. Share that on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Email ideas@wpr.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, on the Friday News Roundup, the investigation into the January 6th attack casts a wider net, inflation hits a new high, and attention turns to two key homicide trials. That and more today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now, President Joe Biden was at the historic port of Baltimore this week selling the freshly passed infrastructure legislation he's about to sign. He painted a picture of what his administration is seeing in the current economy, setting the stage for the impact of the bill.
And on the good side, we're seeing the highest growth rate in decades, the fastest decrease in unemployment at this point ever since 1950. Jobs are up, wages are up, values are up, and savings are up. But we got problems, too. Many people remain unsettled about the economy, and we all know why. They see higher prices. They go to the store online, and they can't, or they go to the store or go online, and they can't find what they always want and when they want it.
We're going to talk now about where we are economically, including the impact of inflation, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. How's your economy looking right now in your household? Are you seeing inflation, higher prices on key things where you're at? Are you one of the many people who left a job last month? A huge number of people left a job last month. Was it for something better? Maybe better paying? Call in at 800-642-1234. And when you look at the economy, what indicator do you look at? Unemployment, inflation, stock market? 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Thomas Kemp is with us, professor and department chair in the UW-Eau Claire Department of Economics. Tom, welcome back to Central Time.
Glad to be here, Rob.
Let's start with inflation. We got this number from the Labor Department this week, increase in consumer price index of 6.2% in October compared to the previous year. Big number. How clear an indicator of inflation is that?
Yeah, it's getting to be significant. That's some of the highest inflation we've seen in 20 plus years. So while modest compared to the 1970s, it's not something that we're used to here in the States. And so it's setting people on edge a bit for sure.
We've heard from some economic officials, I think of the Federal Reserve, who have used the word transitory to apply to inflation. That can mean a lot of things. Transitory means something could go away tomorrow, or it could mean in a year, but it's not necessarily a long-term fundamental condition. What do economists mean when they say something like this is transitory?
Well, it's a bit of a hedge, isn't it, as you say? I mean, the short of it is that most economists do not believe that this inflation is sort of baked into the economy, if you will. And by that, would mean that it's getting contracted. So for example, if you started seeing cost of living adjustments back in labor arrangements, where every year the employee automatically got a raise of 5 or 6 or 7%, or if, you know, firms were building those kind of increases into their purchasing orders or sales agreements, then of course inflation becomes self-fulfilling because it's effectively contracted, as was the case in the 1970s. That isn't the case at this point. So we expect the things that are causing inflation at this juncture to eventually not be there anymore.
What are those things causing inflation?
Yeah, that's a good question. And economists differ on that. It does seem from my reading the data that most of what's driving inflation at this point is business costs, and most particularly their labor costs. As President Biden mentioned a moment ago, wages are going up. But of course, that contributes to business costs, and some of those get passed through on to consumers. And so we're seeing some of that with inflation.
And let's talk about, I mentioned another big number, a lot of people quitting their jobs in September in a new report that just came out, the Great Resignation, some people have called it, some are calling it the Quittening. That's just me. I made that one up. But what is driving this? Now, it's not people losing their jobs. They're leaving their jobs for one reason or another. What do you see behind that?
Yeah, that's another tough one to know. So the labor market is a fascinating thing right now, at least for us economists, you know, because GDP is up from where we were pre-COVID. So the economy is larger inflation adjusted. So in real terms, than it was ahead of COVID. But yet we're missing over 3 million workers from the economy. So we've got fewer people producing more things than we had ahead of COVID. And why people are choosing to exit the labor market or to not return there's probably a million reasons out there.
Right. Some of it is, some people have pointed it as a good news story. People are confident enough to leave their jobs either because they've got a better job lined up already, or they're confident that they're going to find that better job. So in one reading of it, it's tough for business owners who are seeing people quit, but maybe it's an optimistic sign.
Yeah. You know, when we look at the data, we look at job leavers and then we look at new hires. Mm-hmm. Those two numbers track pretty nicely. So what it looks like is going on here is we're getting a lot more labor churn. So people leaving one job and then picking up another job, which, you know, most economists agree that is a good thing because you have people leaving jobs that maybe they were ill suited towards and moving to jobs that they're better suited towards, which of course makes us all better off because they're going to be more productive at those new jobs.
Talking to Thomas Kemp, professor and department chair at UW-Claire's Department of Economics, looking at lots of economic news out there, some of it pointing in different directions. When we ask, how's the economy doing? You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about inflation? Are you noticing? Are you feeling the pinch of higher prices where you are? Have you participated in the quittening? Have you left a job? Why? Did you move on to another one? Did you decide to retire early, maybe because you're worried about risks of COVID at your workplace? We've heard a lot of different stories, even just here on Central Time. Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Tom, I've heard from economists since early in the pandemic who said, you know, to fix the economy, fix the pandemic. How much do you see the still not done pandemic weighing on different parts of the economy?
Yeah, I think it's weighing quite heavily. In fact, if we think about it broadly, I think it probably accounts for most of the issues that we have. You know, of course, we have the pandemic, which has, well, we all are well aware of the effects there. But then we have the psychological impacts of the pandemic too, which are almost certainly at this point, you know, well over a year into this, weighing heavily on a lot of people's thinking, both in terms of the jobs they're willing to do and what they're purchasing.
Now let's turn toward the stock market. Just by the raw numbers of the stock market, it's done pretty well this year. The Biden administration not really spiking footballs on that one, not celebrating that much. And I know people often point out the stock market is not the economy. How important is it to watch what the market is doing as one, I guess, indicator, one symptom of how the overall economy is doing?
Well, it's important, right? People pay close attention to it. A lot of people have retirement plans, other interests in maintaining the value of the stock market, and people are going to make current consumption decisions. You know, should I buy a new car? What are my stocks doing? So it matters. But that said, we should recognize that, you know, when the stock market goes up, it doesn't necessarily mean that the economy is doing good. It just means that certain aspects of the economy are doing good. And conversely, it can go down and the economy could be doing well, you know, on the whole. So it's not something we should ignore, but we want to be careful when we attribute its change in value to overall economic performance.
And another, of course, thing people watch for are the unemployment numbers. A lot better than, say, a year ago as we emerge from the worst times of the pandemic. I think not still to where we were pre-pandemic. What are you watching for in employment numbers?
Yeah, the unemployment numbers are way down, right? So we're back into the low fours at this point, which is quite good by historical standards. But boy, there's still a large number of folks that left the labor market when COVID hit, and they haven't come back. So we've got a labor force participation rate now of 61.5%, just about. Now, to give you some idea, that's about where we were in the mid-1970s. So that's, you know, before the great boom of the late 70s and 80s and 90s, where you had a lot of husbands and wives both working. You know, we've been moving back to almost a time before that, where we're looking at, you know, a lot of households are sending one adult in the labor force. And so that's a bit of a mystery what's going on there. And it's certainly driving a lot of what we see in terms of prices.
We're talking to UW-Eau Claire economics professor Thomas Kemp about inflation and other economic indicators. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If I asked you, how's the economy doing? What would you say? What do you point to measure that? How is it going for you? Have you left a job lately, as so many people did, including just in September and the latest numbers out? Are you worried about prices going up where you are? Are you in the supply chain somewhere? Are you seeing hiccups or even burps? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation, hear from some of you, coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We continue our talk with Thomas Kemp, professor and department chair at the UW-Eau Claire Department of Economics, talking about rising inflation and other factors that make up the health of the national economy and how to make sense of them in this moment. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Love to hear your story of staying at a job, leaving a job, why you did either or both. 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to your calls now. Sonia is with us in Mequon. Sonia, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you want to bring up, Sonia?
So I thought it was an interesting topic that you guys brought up in regards to why people are leaving the workforce in such significant numbers. And so I wanted to share my perception on why this is, you know, happening at such concentrated levels. I feel like when COVID hit, whatever your quality of life was that you were experiencing at that juncture, it was extremely concentrated. So, you know, I'm a caregiver, I'm a student, I take care of the household, and I do this all on my own. I don't have any help. My mother has dementia, and I couldn't get anybody to come in and help me. And it made me realize at that time that this is really what I have to do as far as going back to school and becoming a nurse. So it made me really hold on tight to my dream. But I think people who didn't necessarily have a dream, they realized they're really what their quality of life was, what their daily grind was. Okay. And then when you factor that, it's so multifactorial, but when you factor that in addition to the aspect of, we didn't have the socialization of the outside world to dilute those experiences that we were having in our homes with our family members in that tight introspective bubble that we were in.
I gotcha, Sonia. Interesting point. And I've heard this from some callers on other conversations, Tom, that the pandemic gave people a real opportunity and impetus to rethink their lives, including their work lives. And that might be part of what's leading people to change and or leave careers. What do you think?
Yeah, I think Sonia makes a lot of sense. I spent a chunk of time at home too. And I tell you, it was nice spending time with my daughter, who was actually at home from school, and my wife, who was also working from home for a while. And it did really make me think about what we're all doing here, I guess, is one way of saying it. And that's what I hear Sonia saying on the call. And, that may be the case. We may be in the midst of a reevaluation of work-life balance in American culture. And that is going to be an interesting thing to watch, and I think an exciting thing for us all to live through and to think about, how we want to order our lives going forward from this.
Sonia, thanks for the call. We'll go to Tom now in Milwaukee. Tom, hi.
Hi. I'm trying to figure out the ramifications of the current inflation. It seems to me that a lot of the cause for inflation is the increase in wages for at the lower end of the economic spectrum. And so if more people at the lower end are getting living wages now, clearly doctors and lawyers, they're not getting increases in the salaries in the same way. So if people are getting more of a living wage at the lower end, that would cause possibly less need for government help. So is this a good thing?
Tom, thanks for the call. Do we know our wage gains really happening to that extent at lower levels? Tom, do we have the data on that yet?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I don't have the data and that sort of level of specificity that I would know that. But what Tom, the caller, is saying is correct. Inflation is always redistributive. So it moves things around society. And so we don't want to jump right on the bandwagon of saying that everything is bad about this. And we don't want to say it's good either, right? Inflation is going to change things. And it may change some things for the better. It may mean that we reduce income inequality. It may mean that folks at the bottom end up with a better wage relative to the goods and services that they have to buy. It may mean better working conditions, but it's also going to mean uncertainty too. So, we're going to be less certain about, for example, saving for retirement or in terms of business, knowing what their cost structure is going to be like down the line. So inflation changes things. Some things could be better and other things are worse.
Tom, thanks for that call. We'll go now to Kent in Milwaukee. Kent, hi.
Hi. What I'm calling about, there's this mystery about the Great Resignation, as it's been called. And my thought is something that's been going on in the background for 10 years now or more is the baby boomer retirement wave. That wave of people who entered the workforce is getting up there now, and that's going to peak probably in the next, 5-6 years or so. And I think the peak has already passed, but I think that'll be the tail end of it, 5 or 6 years. And nobody brings that up in terms of the tightening of the workforce. So I believe that is a major factor. People, retirement accounts have built up, the stock market's at a high, and people have looked around and thought, I can afford to retire now. Maybe I'm going to. So people who can retire early are, and we've got that wave of baby boomers retiring that's been going on for some time.
Kent, thanks a lot for the call. And pre-pandemic, Tom, I know we did segments on, Industry X or Profession X is seeing shortages because the baby boomers, as Kent was mentioning, are retiring. Now, if you're in that older group, you're also more vulnerable to COVID. Do you see that speeding up the baby boomer retirement that Kent's talking about?
Well, I imagine that's so. But it should be noted that the drop off in the labor force participation rate had been occurring for some years, and that probably was largely due to the baby boomers. But this event, this COVID event, is a specific event. There is a very precipitous drop off in labor force participation that we see when COVID starts, and it bounces back somewhat this last year, but we're just not at the levels we were before. Whereas before we had a kind of steady decline, people were kind of exiting the labor market. But with COVID, there's just like the floor dropped out of it. So there is something special going on here. is not just demographics. There has to be a little bit more to it. And, you know, it's an interesting thing because the two ideas are related because, you know, so as I mentioned, GDP is up, but we have fewer workers. So you've got fewer people building more stuff effectively than we had before COVID. And, you know, what you're also showing in the data is that those folks are working longer hours. So you have fewer people working longer hours, making up the growing economy. And, you know, I suspect that that's also contributing to some of the issues that Sonia was talking about in the earlier call about quality of life and people really asking questions about, you know, what we're all doing here.
Kent, thanks for that call. We're talking about the economy and different ways to measure it with Tom Kemp from the UW-Eau Claire Department of Economics. Let's go back to your calls now. Rana is with us in Cameron. Rana, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. So I recently used my truck as collateral to get a small loan for my daughter to finish college. And I have a 2015 Chevy Silverado. And as she was looking up the value according to Kelley Blue Book, she told me my truck appreciated and my truck is actually worth several thousand dollars more now than when I purchased it in 2018. And I said to her, would you look that up again? Because that just doesn't seem right. Trucks don't make money. They depreciate. And that's when I thought, okay, this is real. This is really happening. And I guess that's just all I have is an observation and a comment on my part.
Super interesting observation, Rana. Now, I could see that maybe being partly an inflation story, Tom, but more specifically, I mean, we've talked on this show in the past about a shortage of cars, new and used, driving up prices that might be going on here.
Yeah, well, absolutely. I know I was lucky enough to buy a car just before COVID too, and I'm sure glad I did. The funny thing about inflation, right, is if you're holding money, the value of the money goes down. But if you're holding real things like cars, in this case, the prices are going up, right? So the price of your asset is going up. So this is what I was talking about a little earlier, that inflation is redistributive. It moves things around. If you had bought a car before COVID, and inflation, you know, now it's worth more. If you were holding cash over that period, it's now worth less. So total value has moved from the person holding the car or person holding cash to the person with the car. Similarly with housing, right? So housing prices are going up. So if you're sitting on housing, you know, you're okay. You're doing all right.
Rana, thanks for that call. In our last half a minute or so, Tom, what are you watching for next? What piece of information are you curious to see?
Yeah, I'm keeping a close eye on labor force participation. I'm looking to see whether we're going to get folks back to work, whether wages are going to stabilize. So wages have moved up. Are they going to keep moving up? Are they going to stabilize? That's what I'm going to be paying attention to, because that's what's really going to tell us whether these prices stabilize.
Tom, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Rob. It's always a pleasure.
That's Thomas Kemp, professor and department chair at the UW-Eau Claire Department of Economics. We talked to him today about the state of the economy and inflation, how to sort out different economic indicators. Thanks to everyone who called in to share your own thoughts and your stories. You can keep doing that. Tweet us at Central Time WPR or email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, humankind has faced a lot of devastating diseases throughout history, and there may be some lessons we could still learn today. We'll talk to the author of the new book, The Plague Cycle. Plus, have you seen this in the news? We'll check out the discovery of a 1,000-year-old boat in a Wisconsin lake. That and more coming up Monday here on Central Time.